Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell. With me today, Susan Arthur. Susan, today we're going to talk about something that really stretches across all areas of estate planning. One could say all areas of the law, but certainly all areas of elder law and estate planning. And that's the tendency of people to order or obtain or allow themselves to be given forms. Mm-hmm. Now, many of us think, well, forms are convenient, mm-hmm. and they allow you to get things completed fast.
I don't want to have to take the time out of my day to deal with this.
Right. All we have to do is address the blanks.
Right.
And the fewer blanks, the better.
Right.
And it's ideal if there are no blanks.
It comes pre-filled in.
Well, and you know, we laugh, but there's some truth in that. And what people don't realize is you lose a lot when you allow yourself to be a recipient of these forms. Now, I get it. You know, there are lots of online companies out there, LegalZoom and others, and I'm not picking on LegalZoom. I think that there's a place in the market for forms. And I know also that companies who do online legal services now, though, have tried to provide some element of customization. But I think the reason that it's been popular is because of two things. Probably in this order. Cheap. Mm-hmm. Everybody's out there saying, yep, that's a good thing, cheap. And convenient. The point you raised is that it's fast.
It is.
Doesn't take much time, and it's done. And it pertains to something nobody wants to talk about anyway. You have the perfect storm here. You have a subject matter that people are continually trying to avoid, and if they have to deal with it, let's make it quick. And you pay a price for that. And what's interesting about it, though, what magnifies the implications of this or the problems of this is that these things are often the most important things in your life. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you'd step back in a moment of complete clarity, more often that clarity will come later in life versus early. Mm-hmm. And you were to step back and say, what are the things that I really, really care about in my life? And there would be several things on that list, but I would argue that the top 3, 4, 5 items are going to include your legacy for the people you care about, your security in your final years. Mm-hmm. Often, maybe that's even number one for many people, is I don't want to be a problem for other people. I want to be self-sufficient, or at least I want to be able to have the resources to pay for my care.
Right.
And you know that you're about to embark on a period where you may not be capable of caring for yourself. So you have to have things in place.
Right.
And if you don't have things in place, then somebody's going to have to pick up the slack. Mm-hmm. And it's often a family member.
And I think one thing that we often forget about, when I think of the word will, I often just think of that legacy. I forget that part of estate planning and part of that preparing for the future includes things for my own life while I'm still here. And I think we just focus on the legacy that we're going to live. I'm going to leave my stuff. And that's what we want to get taken care of. And we forget that there's another piece of that, and that's planning ahead for when we are unable to care for ourselves.
Yeah. And we might call it the last third of our life. Mm-hmm. I have to say that I believe that elder law in many ways is more attractive to clients than what we think of as traditional estate planning, because I think the primary focus with elder law is providing for that last third of your life, doing the things that will maximize the chances that these will be your happiest years and that they will be self-sufficient years in which you've made arrangements to pay for whatever costs might accompany your aging process. And that you'll be able to have those things in a way that you can still enjoy life to the maximum. And then, of course, secondarily, I would suggest, would be thinking about, okay, well, how do we allocate what's left and the legacy? Some people would reverse that order, but in either case, everyone agrees you should give a lot of thought to the last years of your life. And we're talking decades here.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we think about this planning, there is an implication to say, okay, so there's a form available, and how much is it? Oh, $300, done.
Oh, it's not even that much.
I mean, how low can you go?
I was going to say, I actually looked online just for curiosity, and it was pretty inexpensive, under $100 for a basic will. Now, they had different levels that you could buy, or different depending on how much you needed. If you wanted to get advice from an attorney, so they have addressed that a little bit and said, oh, well, and that cost you a little bit extra. Then, so that took you over the $100 mark. But really, you could actually do this if you think you have not very much for under $100. Tell me why that's not so great, because that sure does sound attractive.
Well, I mean, the price is good.
The price is good.
And you know, it's like a lot of things where you feel like it's a bargain and you can't pass it up. And often, though, the consequences of that decision are felt by others, mm-hmm. and not even the person who's purchasing. This is a classic case of that. The consequences of that decision are going to be borne primarily by your loved ones. And if you want to know how much that decision costs your loved ones, you can go online. You can look up what is under the personal representative compensation percentages, which under Missouri statutes, Missouri annotated statutes. If you put in those keywords, you'll probably bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it will tell you what percentages you're paying. And you'll find that it's far more,
mm-hmm.
than any savings you realize by paying $100 versus what you otherwise would have paid for your estate planning. So there's a huge price for that decision, apart from the fact that it's a form, which, mm-hmm. is a different discussion. But just putting that aside for a moment, assuming that the document represents what it should say, then you've still imposed a huge cost on people that you care about. But you'll never see that, so it's easy to ignore it and easy to not think about it. But the primary problem with that is not that point, but it's that you bought a form that in all probability does not reflect as well as it should your primary concerns. One thing we should step back here, and Susan, and talk about what has been the waves of popularity over time. You know, there are fashions, for lack of a better word, trends. I'll, mm-hmm. use that word. There are trends in the law, especially in estate planning, and over time, some things become real popular, and then there'll be a period of time, perhaps, where their popularity will ebb. So I can say that with respect to what's called a revocable trust. Many of you listening may remember that there were seminars done, especially in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, and what was sold at these seminars or was advocated was a living trust, or, mm-hmm. and some were even, I think, trademarked a loving trust. Same thing fundamentally as a revocable trust. And those, during that period of time, those were very popular, and lots of people did that. Those were more than a will, as they should have been, and they are today. If you decide to do a revocable trust instead of a will, then yes, you'll pay more. You should. And if you're not paying more, you probably shouldn't go with the trust,
right.
because it's not going to be what you want. But then there was a period of time when those became less popular, and there were some theorists, commentators, sideline lawyers, whatever you want to say, and I'm sure some reputable lawyers certainly would have taken this view, I believe, that well, you know, really, it doesn't make sense to argue that you should always have a trust, because there are some people who don't have a significant amount of assets. And if you don't have any assets to speak of, then you're incurring this additional cost for a trust, which the difference can be easily a couple $1,000 for a trust. We've talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to use numbers because I know it can vary, but I'm just trying to be helpful to our listeners. And if they go and talk to a lawyer who does a lot of this, they're probably going, they should expect to pay at least a couple thousand for a good trust, maybe 2,500, maybe a little less. I shouldn't say at least 2,000, but so you can see that even if you have a will done appropriately, while you should definitely expect to pay more than $100, you'd probably still pay, unless you have a complicated estate. If you have a simple estate, you'd probably pay less than $500 for, mm-hmm. a will done properly. And keep in mind, a will is not as simple as it sounds like. In a will, you can have what's called a testamentary trust, meaning a trust that's created in the will that can create this vehicle that allows the people you love to enjoy lots of benefits over multiple generations. In Missouri, for example, you can have dynasty trusts. So a will can be complicated, and you don't have to be rich in order to have a complicated will. But still, it's not unusual to get that will done for $500, $600. I would argue that even though that's significantly less than $2,000 or $2,500, you need to think about, number one, the cost that's going to come. We made mention a few moments ago what that can be. If you have a significant amount of assets, I mean, it can easily be $20,000, $30,000. Do the math. I don't want to tell you what it'll be. Look up the schedule of charges and recognize that that will be paid the lawyer as well as the personal representative. And there are other charges associated with it. There are the advertising costs, any costs associated with valuation or appraisal of assets. Those are all charges that are paid for out of your estate.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to the one-year delay, and typically it is a year, that you'll have an opportunity for creditors to come forward. You'll have an opportunity for any loved ones who might dispute the allocation. They might be heirs who feel that maybe the will isn't or shouldn't be valid for whatever reason. So for all these reasons, wills often not the first choice for people. But there was this period of time, and I get this argument. Let me be, I'll assume the role of devil's advocate here from my perspective. There were some commentators, reputable lawyers, who argued in the aftermath of the 90s when there's this huge popularity of these trusts and whatnot, that you know, these were more expensive. These people were paying whatever they were paying then. Back then, it's probably $1,500 or so, which was mm-hmm. a lot more than you'd have paid for your average will back then. So these commentators were saying, you know, if you're just an average Joe, you could easily get the will, and you don't need the trust, and it's not serving the consumer to do the living trust. They don't need that sort of thing. Well, I mean, certainly I would agree with that if we're talking about small estates. Small estates are people who have less than, under our statutes in Missouri, less than $40,000.
Okay, that was my question. What if you own a house, you are not going to have a small estate.
No. And that's the point. As I talk to our audience, I'm making an assumption. Number one, I always assume our audience is over 65.
Mm-hmm.
Those of you who are younger, you're allowed to listen, but the show's not designed primarily for you. What you learn will be useful in your later life, so listen up. But still, I assume that they're 65 and older, and I assume that they have some assets, not that they're wealthy. As we've talked here before, elder lawyers, for the most part, represent the poor, not the poor so much because the poor are going to qualify for lots of programs for long-term care like Medicaid, mm-hmm. et cetera. So there are various programs available for those needs. And also, they may not have an asset transmission problem because they don't have assets to speak of. On the other extreme are wealthy people. Wealthy people have lots of tax issues and other issues that elder law is not designed to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that bulge in the middle that we talk so often about in the show. It's the middle class who I think are most in need of this information about how to plan for their care as they age in a way that doesn't force them to liquidate everything they've worked for. And then also to talk to them about a better way to leave a legacy. But for these people, they're going to all have some assets that are going to be significantly more than $100,000. Maybe it's $300,000, maybe it's $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, whatever. Maybe less than $1 million. Most would be less than $1 million. But those of you listening get it. You could be middle class and have $1 million in assets when you figure you're home.
Mm-hmm.
And while that's blessed. In international terms, I mean, as the world would view that, in the U.S. we are blessed, but we also know how quickly that money can be consumed by medical costs and other catastrophic occurrences as we age.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I'm talking to our listeners, my response to the commentators who would say, well, really, if you don't have a lot of money, yeah, just do a will and spend a couple $100. I wonder if they're really thinking about their mother or their father. Now, they may be, in fairness to them, they may be. I don't want to accuse them of being dismissive. But I do think there's some elitism there. I think that if you, let's assume you have $300,000 or $400,000. And so would this person suggest that that's so little money that you should use a will. Now, that's a little bit of a complicated discussion because I want to be fair to my opposite number in this scenario. I want to be fair to somebody who would disagree with the vast majority of middle class people having trust, which is my argument. Mm-hmm. So let me give the best force possible to those who would argue against that. They would say, well, first of all, you can have some alternative ways to give assets away. They might say that. And that means you can have, for example, a beneficiary deed. That means that you, if you put somebody's name on the deed through a beneficiary deed process, you're not making them a co-owner while you're alive, which you definitely don't want to do.
Right.
Well, I think, appreciate that. But you can name them without making them a co-owner, which means that when you pass, it doesn't go into your estate. Similar thing when you have a transfer on death provision or a POD, a payable on death provision associated with a bank account or a brokerage account would be a TOD typically. So there are various devices by which on an asset-by-asset basis you can transfer assets to people you love. But those transfers are going to be dumping the asset in their lap, meaning that there are none of those protective opportunities that we talk about on this show where you can transmit those assets to people you love in a way that makes it far more beneficial for them than if you simply dump it on them mm-hmm. in their lap. But that's the alternative, is dumping it in their lap through those devices. And then, of course, there's the cost associated with probate that we just described if it goes through probate.
What if someone forgets? I mean, I was in doing research for this show. I looked up some information, and here's a story of a real-life example of a man who used one of the do-it-yourself forms, put everything together, thought he was doing fine. He looked up some stuff. He realized he there was not something that took care of the information that would have been left, like he forgot something. Turns out he had purchased some stocks that he had not mentioned, forgot he had them, didn't remember anything. And they were valued from the phone company after different mergers and acquisitions over $1.5 million. And he forgot them. And so that $1.5 million worth of stocks did not go directly to the descendants. They went into probate.
Yeah.
And so that was just a really example. I mean, that's one of the advantages of a trust, isn't it?
It is. And there's a couple of cautionary points there. One is that a trust gives you an opportunity to allow things to avoid probate. However, you've got to put items in trust. And when you order forms, those forms do not necessarily direct you to put those things in there, or they can even have you put things in your trust that can be a problem that should have been handled differently. For example, tax-deferred assets. IRAs are a good example, 401ks. These are not items that you want to transfer directly into your trust, typically, because it will trigger some taxes. Mm. The way you do that is you make your trust the beneficiary. So when you pass, the moment you pass, without going through probate, no judges, no lawyers involved, et cetera, it is transferred to the trust itself. That is a better way to do it. But in the scenario you describe, and it's very easy to happen, you know, you order a form mm-hmm. and it says trust, revocable trust. So you think, okay, I can handle this. So you fill out forms, and then you come to the point where, okay, I need to transfer my assets in here. If that's not handled correctly, then you end up with the very scenario you're describing. And believe me, that happens all the time. As a matter of fact, it's not unusual for it to happen even when you've hired a lawyer to do it. So let me give you a suggestion, those of you listening who hopefully I've persuaded you that in all probability, the majority of you, put it that way, you'll benefit from a trust. But go talk to a lawyer. Ask him these questions. Go to a lawyer, though, that practices exclusively in the area of estate planning or elder law. Naturally, I suggest you talk to an elder lawyer first, but there are wonderful estate planning lawyers who do some of the same issues. But the bottom line is, go to them, ask them. But if they recommend a trust, ask them, will you be transferring the assets into the trust? Or is this my responsibility? And I can tell you historically, I'm guilty of this. I'll say this. Years ago when I practiced in this area, I thought my job was done. I prepared what I was convinced and still am is a wonderful trust. And I would I would hand the client these instructions as to how they transfer their assets. And I felt my job was done.
Because surely they're going to do that, right?
Yeah. So the client, you know, we shake hands, the client's happy. And now I realize, as I've read studies that have been done since then, one that was done in Washington State, in which they check to see what's the outcome of people who have estate planning. And something north of 90% of those people who had developed a plan, it was not what happened when they died.
Wow.
And I'm, without knowing the details of the ways in which those trains went off the track, I have no doubt in my mind that a prominent problem was one where people did not follow up and do it. It's not an indictment of people who get trusts done. It's just that life pulls your attention away from these things. These are things you don't want to do anyway, but it pulls you away. And so it's easy to not get to it.
And sometimes you do the big ones. Maybe you thought of the first four, and you got the first four done, and you thought, and then you're right. You get distracted, or something comes up, or you have a health issue, or you go on vacation, and you come back, and you put that paper aside, and it's filed, and you totally forget about it.
Yeah, and that's what happened in this case, I suspect. In this case, there was an asset that was overlooked. But yeah, more likely, it's what you say. It's more likely that these responsible people do some of it. I mean, they don't. It's not that they do none of it. They probably do some of it. But then it's those assets that come along down the road. So in addition to maybe not getting it all soon after they complete the trust, there probably is a period when they forget about it entirely. So 3, 4, 5 years later, they sell their house, they buy a new house, they don't put the new house in the trust. So, I mean, I don't want to give our listeners the impression that trusts require a whole lot of time. They really don't. They're low maintenance. But they require a little bit of attention. So it means that you occasionally, you assure that whenever you open a new bank account, you probably don't do that every day. Whenever you open a new brokerage account, similar thing. You simply assure that it's in the trust. Those things don't happen often, but when they do, then you just be sure that you dot that I and cross that T.
So now the best thing, what you're recommending, is not necessarily to hand your client the information and say, here, take care of this. This is something that a good elder law attorney will do, and they'll take care of transferring all those things into the trust for you.
Yeah, and you're right. That's the point that ties in with where we were a few moments ago is that whenever you do hire a lawyer to do this, you should insist that the lawyer complete the task. And for the kind of money you're probably paying, the kind of money we've talked about, that's a reasonable thing to expect, is that it should be included. You shouldn't have to pay extra for that.
There's no extra charge for that normally.
There shouldn't be. You should say to your lawyer that you think that it should be included, and I think most lawyers would not give you pushback on that. The thing is, that lawyer will get it done so much more efficiently. They'll still need your participation. I mean, there are privacy issues, and you'll need to authorize certain things with banks and brokerage firms. But beyond that, the lead can be taken by their crack legal assistant and others who are often very familiar with this process, and even the principals that are involved at each of these institutions around town. But let me emphasize, though, that whenever you're thinking about a living trust, I really want to push back on the idea that some lawyers still advocate that I was describing a few moments ago, where, look, if you don't have much, and there's a little bit of elitism, quite frankly, in that view, which often they're assuming that anybody with less than $1 million, they have too little to worry about. I don't want to be too harsh here, but I think there's
that's probably a lot of us.
I think there's a tone to that where the suggestion that common people don't need trust. When we're talking about a difference here of, grab a number, $1,500, the difference between your will done properly and your trust. I mean, I think that your life and your loved ones do justify that cost. And I find it offensive that lawyer may have been talking to members of my family, for example, in Kentucky, and other people, many of whom I grew up with in Appalachia, is that maybe they're not wealthy, but no, they don't want to go through probate.
Sure.
And they want to have a plan in which they can pass their things along in an organized way, where they can allow their children, the loved ones, to have asset protection, which is huge, to be able to not only get money, but to get money that will be protected from the divorce of your children. Is there anything, those of you listening, are there many things that would bother you more than the thought that this person that you might like least at that point would be getting half of anything you give to your sons or daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the reality. We know the statistics. I mean, there's a 50-50 chance. I mean, so it's a real issue. And whenever you leave money to your loved ones, your grandkids will not qualify any longer for those financial aid packages for college, for all those scholarships that have a need component, which is the vast majority, all those need-based programs that are associated with special needs. Now, you may say, well, I don't have a special needs child, but we don't know whether we'll have that in 10 years or 15
right.
years. Things happen. And what about the long-term care of your children? I mean, your 40-year-old son or daughter, I mean, they will be looking at long-term care costs in 20, 30 years. If you leave the money to them in the proper way through a trust, then what you allow them to do is to be able to have that protected from being considered for school loans for your children, for long-term care, lawsuits, with all the ways in which we can be on the receiving end mm-hmm. of litigation. We know about that in America, tort law, et cetera. Divorce. I mean, there are just multiple reasons why you want to leave your assets for your children in a way that is so much more powerful and so much more helpful than it would otherwise be. And the primary tool that you do that with is with a trust. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll finish talking about some of these distinctions in terms of your planning, both during the balance of your life and when you pass, about whether you want to consider trusts or wills and why you should stay away from being handed a form. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back with Elder Talk. We're talking about generally the issue of, does it make sense to order forms when they're convenient, they're relatively cheap, to deal with matters relating to wills, trusts, etc. And not surprisingly, I think that those of you out there hear me say that you should insist on something that meets your particular needs. And for you to be placed into a stereotype by which a single form assumes that you want things that other people want, it's just not a fair assumption. I mean, the bottom line is that these are very personal decisions, and you would expect significant variation. Here's a good analogy. Whenever we talk about documents versus planning, I think that's a better way to say it, forms versus planning, is imagine this scenario. Imagine that you've made a decision that you want to buy a house. I mean, a house is a very big decision, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very important, a lot of money involved. So you go see a realtor because you say, this is the person through whom we buy houses. And you come in, you sit down in front of the realtor's desk, and the realtor says, what can I help you with? And you say, well, I want to buy a house. And the realtor says, well, how much do you want to spend? And I want to spend maybe, $300,000. Realtor says, okay. He reaches down, he opens a drawer on his left-hand side, he pulls out a deed, and he pushes it across the table and says, there, that's $300,000. And you look at this form, you examine it, you can see that it's notarized. You can see that there's a legal description. You don't question that this is, in fact, a real deed, and it's a real deed to a house that you can believe has been appraised for $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you're thinking, this would be silly. How can he possibly make the assumption that something so important to me, something that involves among the largest asset that I will acquire during my lifetime, okay, significant part of my net worth, would be at stake here, and that I would allow him to simply give me a document without asking me the particularities of my situation. And while we all readily agree that that's absurd, because you would be thinking to yourself, gee, I want 3 bedrooms.
Right.
I want a master on the ground level. I want masonry.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to be in walking distance of my shopping.
First floor laundry.
Yes, yes. So you and I, Susan, would come up with a different list, right?
That's right.
There'd be some similarities.
You're not caring about the laundry, are you?
No. and I can tell you that some of us would want a big yard, some of us want a small yard. And the bottom line is, This is a very personal decision, and it's a very important decision. And this is a good analogy. It's a fitting analogy for what happens when you go to see a lawyer and you go to see him about a very important matter, a matter that involves among the most important decisions you'll make as to your assets and other things. And often what happens, whether you know it or not, is the lawyer has reached down, he's pulled a form out of that left-hand lower drawer, and he's pushed across the table and say, there you go, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he doesn't do it quite that crudely.
Right.
It doesn't happen while you're sitting there. You pay him, you leave, maybe you come back in a few days, and in the meantime, he's pulled the form out of the drawer and pushed it across the table, and you think, wow, he's been working on this for 48 hours.
Right.
I'm impressed with this lawyer.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't want to accuse, I don't want to be unfair to my brethren, because the bottom line is none of us, when we do estate planning, start entirely from scratch. I mean, our clients want us to benefit from the fact that we've done 100 people before them or 1,000 people before them. And so, of course, you don't want to a lawyer that literally starts from scratch from every document. That
right.
would be risky to the client.
Exactly.
But we know that there's a happy meeting place between pulling a form out of the lower left-hand drawer and on the one extreme and the other starting afresh entirely new with every matter that comes in. We don't want to be on either end of that spectrum. We can't afford to be on the end where it starts from scratch, nor would it be as good a document.
Mm-hmm.
But we definitely don't want to be in the end where we're handing a form, because then we're paying too much. So the point is, many people feel that when they go to a lawyer that they're getting something that's very customized. And I think that they need to insist that it should be customized. And if they don't insist, it might not be that customized. And I'm not saying that the lawyer will hand them what they would order online. In fairness, a lawyer is going to, there'll be some customization. But there may not be as much as you want. I mean, you're entitled, if you're paying, say, $500 for a will, you're paying a lot more than you would pay if you ordered a form.
Mm-hmm.
So is it not reasonable for you to talk to your lawyer and to have some specifics and to expect for him to ask a fairly detailed list of questions about things that are important to you and about your set of priorities?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we expect that, and we should. But all too often it doesn't happen. So I agree that if your lawyer is going to hand you a form, order it offline.
Right.
And you know I'm telling you to don't do either of those things. But the point is, when you talk to your lawyer, yes, you would expect to pay more, whether it's a trust or will. But be prepared for that. But simultaneously, insist that they take a lot of time to assure that your particular needs are met. Let me give you an example. So when we talk about, for example, powers of attorney, that's a classic example. Many people, whenever I speak at workshops and whatnot, I'll ask for a show of hands. How many have a power of attorney? Maybe half the room raise their hand. Now, I don't want to embarrass anyone, so I won't ask them to raise their hands. But I say, I'm willing to bet, though, that you don't know what your power of attorney says. You know that you have a form that at the top, it denominates that form as a power of attorney. But if I asked you some key questions about the contents of that document, I'm willing to bet that perhaps none of you here could answer them. I said, for example, and I'll go through a series of things where the answers to these questions would vary
mm-hmm.
among the different people in the room. They wouldn't all have the same answer. For example, the issue about a springing power. A springing power means it's not valid until an event occurs, like you're declared incompetent. Well, many people think, well, gee, a power of attorney, they understand that this is something that is to kick in, a durable power of attorney, is to kick in if they become incompetent. Hugely important document. It means if you have a heart attack, car accident, or even more gradually become incompetent, you want someone to be able to act on your behalf without having to hire a lawyer and go to the courthouse and have a guardianship hearing,
mm-hmm.
which is the ugly alternative, ugly and expensive.
Or something no one wants to do.
So a durable power of attorney is hugely important. But it's not a box that you simply check off by ordering a form. So going to this hypothetical presentation, so I said, let me give you some examples of things that you need to think about whether you want it or don't want it in your form. So I would mention, for example, this issue of springing. Some people would say, well, of course I don't want anyone to have all the power that they would have to be able to access all my accounts until I'm incompetent. I wouldn't want them to have it immediately. But there's an argument, a very good argument, for saying they should have it immediately, because if they don't, then you can delay it becoming activated. And if you think you can't trust the person when you're competent, what do you think they're going to do when you're incompetent?
Exactly.
And this document often appears to tellers, to clerks at other financial institutions, people who are not going to have the sophistication to deal with anything that is a new or additional hurdle before the document's valid. So many people, I would argue, should choose carefully the person they're given the power to and then give it to them. But that's a question that will vary. I mean, reasonable people will have different opinions. Some will want there to be the power to make gifts. Others will not. Some will want powers to make changes to the estate plan. Many others will not. Some will want them to be able to engage in real estate and other transactions. Most people want that, but some people don't. So there can be a significant variation among people. Some would say, well, we want to include multiple people on the same line as having this authority. So it's a shared authority that might list all three of their children, and any one of them could make a decision. That's dangerous, really, to do it in that form, just because you can end up with different opinions.
Exactly.
Another is that they'll have a panel. It'll be a majority vote. So that seems to answer some of the questions, except you've got to get everybody together for every issue.
Yeah.
And that's often awkward and cumbersome. So there are just various other questions that the answers would vary from person to person as to what they want. But if you order a form, then you're going to go into that standardized mold where assumptions are made that everyone fits this particular preference. Same thing when it comes to healthcare directives. Healthcare directives vary. There are lots of issues, believe it or not, that people will disagree about on healthcare. And some will say, for example, that they want to have some items of care discontinued sooner than others. Some will want a personal care plan included, one that goes far beyond simply end-of-life decisions. And these are questions that, believe it or not, you can have that if you want. Now, it's more an advisory segment of the document, but it's hugely influential in long-term care, where there's an obligation now under the Omnibus Nursing Home Act. There's an obligation for nursing homes to do an individual analysis regarding the preferences of every patient. And it's their duty to develop a plan of care that reflects the values and priorities of that particular patient.
So if that patient wants to have sunshine in the afternoons, they want to sit outside, they really enjoy nature, they can have that as part of their plan. Something as simplistic as that, right?
That's a good example. In things like diet, don't assume, those of you listening, don't assume that these things are unimportant at that time. They may be unimportant to you now, but you have to do a thought experiment in which you put yourself in a world in which your world is 1,200 square feet or so. You know, think of the magnitude that these things would have, their importance under those conditions. So whether you're outside or in, sometimes television, you know, what is it you want to, the type of things, the type of music, what is the type of food you like, you don't like. What about religious services, et cetera? There are just so many things that will be hugely important to you in this world that you might occupy at some point down the road. None of us knows, but you have now a chance to design that world in a way that you may not be capable of at that time. And that's through, for example, a personal care plan that would be attached to this document that would be otherwise your durable power of attorney for healthcare, for example. And while, again, it's more advisory than it is being a requirement, I can tell you as a practical matter, because of what I mentioned a few moments ago, I do think that the obligation of nursing homes is, as to all reasonable requests, it has to be reasonable. They have to make a profit. There are some things they can do, some things they can't. But all these things we just mentioned are reasonable. And these are the sort of things where you have an opportunity to make this a very personal, living document in a way that a form can never be.
Right.
And why should you settle for less?
Right. You know, you've lived your whole life with particular wants and desires and wishes and dreams. And it's really sad if those just go away because you're unable to communicate them effectively.
Yeah. And it's an unknown as to, you know, will some of us go through a substantial period of time where we're incompetent? We don't know this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can worry about it, but that doesn't do us any good. I think it makes a whole lot more sense to simply plan for the possibility and then dismiss it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, do what you can. Stay healthy. It's funny, in our Sunday school class this past weekend, we're doing a module or a book in which it's talking about wellness. And I was asked to do a presentation on this chapter regarding mental wellness. And at first I thought, well, wait, now why would I be asked to teach on that? I'm not sure that's my area of expertise. But it involved, the reason I was asked, and I shared it with a physician who she and I both kind of co-taught it. But she dealt with the things about what can you do from a health and fitness standpoint to maximize your chances that you will not have any sort of dementia,
mm-hmm.
that you'll continue to be healthy and functional for the balance of your life. And we know those things include exercise, they include diet, they include cognitive challenges. Studies show that to the extent that you challenge your mind with new things, learning languages, reading, things that trigger different lobes or spheres of your brain, such as learning to play a musical instrument.
I was just going to say, my father-in-law is 82 and he takes piano lessons.
That's a great
and
example.
And I love it.
That would probably be, you can see why that is often suggested, because you're challenging, on the one hand, you're learning to read music.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that area of your brain. And then there's using your fingers, which is something different, eye-hand coordination. So it's really, it's a multiple thing. And those sorts of activities are supposed to be especially good. So I found it interesting to listen to this physician talk about some of these things in these studies. And another big, big, big factor, those of you listening, social interaction. Studies are unanimous in saying that there's something really good for the brain about lots of social interaction. It challenges your brain in a way that sitting alone doesn't. Even sitting alone with a book won't.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just requires a flexibility and triggers neurons that would not otherwise perhaps be fired or whatever it might be. So there's that. And then on the other piece, though, in addition to doing those things, and I think we all should do them, there's the planning piece. And that was what I was asked to speak about. So I talked about, yeah, in addition to doing all these other things, we can't forget the fact that we have to plan for the possibility that we may have a period of time when we're in a long-term care facility, whether or not we have a dementia issue. But these are things that it's not helpful to brood about. It's not helpful to worry about. It's helpful to do something about, to simply be sure you have a wonderful plan. And once that's in place, you know, live a healthy, active life, and you may never need to fall back on that plan. So that's kind of what elder law emphasizes. But circling back to where we began here, we began talking about the fact that your lives, the balance of your life, as well as your legacy, is far too important to be turned over to a form. The great probability is that a form that you order will not perfectly reflect what your desires are. And I would suggest that the $100 or $200 or $300, whatever it is you saved, it's not worth it.
All right. Before we finish up, I'll leave you with two examples of why a form is probably not your best bet. All right. This was True Stories in Atlanta. One lawyer dealt with someone who did a do-it-yourself form, and it came up. It said, do-it-yourself form said, insert your name here. And he ended up leaving his $200,000 to insert your name here. He truly forgot to fill in the name. And then the other poor person, she had another $200,000 to give. And instead of the comma for the 200, comma 000, she put a period. So she left $200 to her estate. So probably, well, the forms may not be the best thing if you're prone to typos.
No. And there are a couple of caveats there, but I think those speak for themselves. So we covered a lot of material here, and we'll circle back next week. Do you know what our topic is set for next week?
I believe the next week we're actually going to look at reverse mortgages and looking at more estate planning for that.
Okay. And we've done reverse mortgages before, but it's been a while. A lot of people commented that they thought it was useful. I think that reverse mortgages is something that more and more people are interested in. So we decided, let's do it again. Are we having back the same expert?
We are. We are.
Yeah, he was very good. So that topic next week. Until then, take care. Another episode of Elder Talk.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.